Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Keith Rathbone. Normally I say coming to you live from Macquarie University, but we're actually coming to you live from my house today. And so I do apologize to listeners if they hear any noise in the background. That's my delightful two-year-old who's just getting into the terrible twos. In fact, I'm here today with Alan Downey. He is the author of The Creator's Game, Lacrosse, Identity, and Indigenous Nationhood, which is out from University of British Columbia Press in 2018. And I note here on the copy of my book, it says the winner, a laureate, a Prix du Canada prize. Thank you very much, Alan, for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm sorry. I also
me.
Should mention Alan is an associate professor at McMaster University. Yes. Sorry. Thank you very much for joining us, Alan.
Well, thanks for having me, Keith. I'm really happy to be here.
I loved this book, Alan. It's been one of my favorites so far in 2020. I wonder if we could just start by having you tell us how this project developed.
Yeah, absolutely. So as mentioned, my name's Alan Downey. I'm Deketh Nkosliwetan and an associate professor in the Department of History and Indigenous Studies program at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. And the idea for examining lacrosse came out of my own experience as an athlete. Actually had played lacrosse since I was about 10 years old. I'm in my mid-30s now. It's really been a big part of my life. I ended up going on a lacrosse scholarship to the United States to a small university called Mercyhurst University in Erie, Pennsylvania. Ended up getting drafted professionally and then ended up playing semi-professionally, and rather than going pro, decided to go to grad school and study the game of lacrosse. As an Indigenous person, when I was growing up, you know, in lacrosse circles, it was generally in North America, it's known to be an Indigenous game. So within lacrosse circles, that's well known. And for me, as an Indigenous youth growing up in an urban setting, that's something that I connected to. Here I was as an Indigenous youth, an Indigenous kid, playing an Indigenous game. And I took a great amount of pride in that. It meant a lot to me to hear stories of Indigenous players, to hear stories of Indigenous communities and where this game came from and its connection to Indigenous peoples. And later what I would find out, its connection to Indigenous sovereignty, self-determination, and identity, which I talk about in the book. But that connection to this Indigenous game as an Indigenous youth was really important for me. It was an empowering thing to hear, to be able to play this Indigenous game. And so after I kind of had my lacrosse career, I would say in my early 20s, I decided to go to grad school. And what better game or what better topic to start studying in grad school than the game I was still kind of playing semi-professionally. And you know, I knew that there was this Indigenous connection to it, but I wanted to kind of look at that more in depth. And so that was my proposal for my master's project at Wilfrid Laurier University in my hometown of Waterloo, Ontario. And kind of grew from there. I started this project off as a short 50-page major research paper for my master's project. My supervisor, Susan Nalen, who is an incredible scholar at Laurier, asked if I would be interested in kind of continuing this project into a PhD. And it kind of rolled from there, where it ended up being about a 350-page dissertation, now turned book. But it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to read. There's a lot of content that I'm hoping we could chat about, but I think there's some kind of methodological or theoretical issues that for me I found fascinating. But one of the things that you do throughout is use what you term or what I feel like is being termed in the book indigenous epistemologies. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how you weren't just studying sports history, maybe in the usual way, but you actually were doing some pretty innovative methodological work as well.
Yeah, one of the things that I say and argue in the introduction is that LaCrosse's theory, that the stories, the oral histories, the epistemologies of Indigenous peoples, particularly of the Haudenosaunee, the Squamish, the Deketh, my nation, all play a really significant role in this storytelling of the history of the game, that you can't compartmentalize lacrosse or other aspects of Indigenous lives because they're interconnected. So what I mean by that is there's no such thing as in kind of a Western framework of compartmentalizing sport differentiated from politics or separated from politics or separated from your epistemologies or separated from your governance system. See, these things within Indigenous communities are all intertwined. And so that's what I mean by lacrosse is theory. In order to know the intricacies of lacrosse from a Haudenosaunee perspective, from a Squamish perspective, from a Mi'kmaq perspective, all these different Indigenous nations across North America that had the game of lacrosse, you need to know not only the intricacies of their knowledge that they were sharing and shared with me, you don't need to know just the intricacies of things directly related to the sport of lacrosse. You need to be exposed to and understand, or at least come to work and grapple with Indigenous forms of governance, Indigenous forms of gender relations and gendered identities, and queerness. You need to come to understand or kind of interact with Indigenous storytelling and Indigenous storytelling methodologies. That's such an important thing to be able to kind of really provide a more accurate or a better picture of what the game of lacrosse means in Indigenous communities. So I really had to kind of wrestle with that. And there's a few other kind of issues going on. And that is that within kind of Canadian historiography, I never saw myself reflected as an Indigenous person within Canada. Generally, the vast majority of historical works are not written by Indigenous people, even when it comes to Indigenous topics. And so the methodologies, the way in which Indigenous communities share their history, share their stories, share their knowledge, share their expertise, is not really reflected in the historiography. And so I had to turn elsewhere. So I turned to my own storytelling methodologies. And that is within my community, a Deketh community, we have tricksters. We call them tricksters. And one in particular named Uzdaz plays a big part in helping me kind of share this history of lacrosse, share my own kind of connections to the game of lacrosse, what I learned from the game from various Indigenous nations and communities. And so I actually use that. I actually talk to Uzdaz in the book, in the introduction of each chapter, to be able to kind of get across, I guess, to address the various anomalies, the various challenges of creating a history like this from an Indigenous perspective, to really challenge time frames, to challenge settler colonialism, and even to challenge the field of Canadian historiography in the way in which they kind of approach Indigenous history and Indigenous topics. And so I turned to people like Leanne Simpson, turned to other Indigenous theorists like Thomas King, novelists, many, many Indigenous theorists and scholars, and incredible people that have been doing this in academic literature for decades now. Some incredible works like Philip Deloria's Playing Indians plays a significant role in this book as well. And it's just a different way of approaching these stories.
Yeah, I can't agree more. I love the, I'm will apologize to you, Alan, and to all the listeners if I mispronounce things, especially as I was reading them in my head. Like in my head, it was Uzdas, but it's Uzdas.
It's close. Yeah. No, it's good. It's like, close.
Yeah. So I will apologize if I mispronounce things, but I loved this kind of framing that you used that was almost kind of an autoethnography that allowed you as the author to emerge in your work in a way that you were kind of making clear what is often unclear, which is the point of view of the author in the subject itself. And then I loved, you know, your resistance to talking about the origins of the game. You call it the creator's game, and you talk about its origins in a way that I think many sports historians wouldn't. We're more like, you know, challenging or troubling the double day myths of baseball, but we're maybe more uncomfortable with the way you do it. So why do you call it the creator's game? And maybe tell us a little bit about in an Indigenous epistemology where lacrosse comes from and how it would have worked in a maybe pre-colonial Indigenous space.
Yeah. So the game of lacrosse, at the time of contact and before contact with non-Indigenous peoples, existed all across North America. So the Mi'kmaq in present-day Nova Scotia, down to the Seminole Nation in what is now present-day Florida, west to the Pomo Nation in California, north to Coast Salish territory, which is Vancouver, North Vancouver, and all in between, Indigenous nations had the game of lacrosse. Now, don't get me wrong, that doesn't mean every Indigenous nation had it, but we do know it was widespread across the continent. And the reference to the creator's game is actually a very specific reference to the Haudenosaunee Nation, formerly known as the Iroquois, because they reference the game as being a gift from the creator. And that actually plays a big part in the prologue. I worked with so many incredible Indigenous knowledge holders and elders, particularly from Haudenosaunee communities and other communities that were willing to share their knowledge, their expertise. I was just so fortunate to have that opportunity. I just had the time and space to be able to write down kind of their expertise, their brilliance, and share that with people. And so they really devoted a lot of time to me to teach me about these things. And the creator's game is actually a reference again, specific to the Haudenosaunee. So they understand that this game of lacrosse has been here since time immemorial, since the very beginning of time. And they have a creation story about it and about actually North America. A woman falls from the sky, and it's in the prologue of the book where the amazing Delmore Jacobs, who's a Cayuga faith keeper, that is, he's basically in charge of, or not so much in charge, but has the role, the position of sharing and keeping the traditions and the culture alive and going for future generations. And he shared these stories with me. And so we know that the game of lacrosse was widespread across North America at the time of contact and afterwards. And I'm really looking at a period from 1860 to kind of the present day. And the reason why I selected that timeline was because I was more interested. I love kind of early Canadian North American history. It's fine. But I'm more of a modernist. So I do modern Indigenous history and sovereignty movements. I'm a historian of sovereignty, nationhood, and self-determination. And so that's what I kind of examined, and that's what I wanted to look at. But what ends up happening is actually Canada takes over the administration of Indigenous affairs or Indian affairs from the colonial office in England in and around 1860. Now, there's kind of a period in which that happens, but that's really the kind of official date that it happens, or at least the year. And so what I'm looking at is actually how this game of lacrosse serves as an interaction, or serves as a space of interaction between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples. The game of lacrosse, we know from, again, time immemorial and throughout the oral histories of Indigenous nations, historically, it's been this critical piece of Indigenous nationhood and the articulation of their self-determination prior to contact, after contact, right up until the modern day. There's many, many stories of this. So one of the really interesting things that I was able to do as I traveled the country and across North America generally is to talk to Indigenous communities and get their different perspectives on the game of lacrosse. Now, just because there was games all across or forms of lacrosse all across North America doesn't mean they all look the same. So in certain areas like the southeast of the United States, they would use a smaller stick. Generally, sometimes they would use two sticks. That's particularly among the Choctaw and the Seminole nations. You go into the Great Lakes region, they could often have one larger stick that they played with. Or out west, there again, they would have a smaller stick. And so it varied. It varied based on the nation, based on their culture, based on their language, based on their governance systems. The rules were all different among Indigenous nations, and they all have their own creation stories and names for the game. And so I had the opportunity to kind of look at that and really engage with that. But then the question becomes, okay, it's well known, actually, I'm not sure if international audiences know this, but it's well known within kind of Canadian history that the game of lacrosse is actually Canada's national sport. Now, it's Canada's national summertime sport, and then hockey is the wintertime sport. And the question became for me, how did that happen? How did this critical piece of Indigenous nationhood and self-determination become kind of part of Canadian folklore and Canadian identity building, particularly with the kind of the history of settler colonialism within Canada, whether it be the dispossession of Indigenous lands, the criminalization of Indigenous peoples, sending Indigenous peoples, including my family, to residential schools to assimilate them, which is now has been kind of it's been determined by a Truth and Reconciliation Commission here that happened within the last few years, that that was a form and an act of cultural genocide. And so with this kind of colonial history, why would Canadians attempt to appropriate this Indigenous element, this something so critical to Indigenous epistemologies? Well, the thing that occurs is that in the 1850s, a person by the name of W.G. Beers is in Montreal, non-Indigenous person, middle class, Anglophone, English speaking, that is, Protestant. He's in the Montreal area at this time. And Canadians in the 1850s and 1860s really don't know what it means to be Canadian at this point. They're still formulating that. They're still trying to figure it out. What differentiates Canadians from Americans or from the Irish or from the English or Scottish or the French? And they're still working that out. Well, enter kind of W.G. Beers, who is introduced to this game of lacrosse in about approximately the 1840s and 1850s. And they're introduced to the game of lacrosse from Indigenous communities that live by in Ganawage and Ganasatage and Akwesasne. These are actually all Mohawk or Ganyagahaga communities. And after seeing this game and starting to play it themselves, these non-Indigenous Montrealers actually come up with this idea of forming their own lacrosse organization. And so in 1856, they start the Montreal Lacrosse Club, and they start to use it as a way to actually formulate and form a Canadian national identity. They do this through visual images, written histories, and media reports. So W.G. Beers is writing to the Montreal Press saying, you have to see this great, quote-unquote, Canadian game. And they're attempting to instill what they consider middle-class British Anglophone Protestant values within a Canadian system through sport. And so as they do this, they use Indigenous performers to play the game of lacrosse and to gather audiences and to write kind of media reports and produce visual images of these games. And one of the big things that is occurring just during this time, of course, is not only is this kind of this formulation of a Canadian identity happening, this and also this kind of insecurity of what it means to be Canadian, but W.G. Beers and others at the Montreal Lacrosse Club decide, you know what, if we take this game, this Indigenous game, and appropriate it as our own, it can be a way in which we can articulate our unique identity as Canadians. See, the way that works is within and under settler colonialism is that these people, these non-Indigenous kind of, let's say, lacrosse enthusiasts, they're foreign to the territories that they are now claiming as their own. So no matter how many generations they had been here, the territories in which they were entering and lived in were not their own, right? They are Indigenous territories. So in the Montreal region, that's Ganyagahaga territory and Anishinaabe territory. It's overlapping, but two different nations. And so they're now trying, these non-Indigenous Canadians attempt to claim these lands as their own. And they're taking those, dispossessing Indigenous peoples of those lands, but they still don't have anything really tying them to place, at least their identity. So what they kind of conclude, or what they start doing, is claiming this game of lacrosse because Indigenous peoples are of the territory. They are from these places. Well, this game of lacrosse also, of course, being Indigenous or native to Indigenous peoples, kind of pun intended there, if you start appropriating that, you then can have a source of you have a source of identity rooted in place. It's actually rooted in land because it is from here. It is of the place. So what we start seeing is that W.G. Beers, a non-Indigenous lacrosse enthusiast, start claiming this game as their own, appropriating it, changing the rules of it, making it kind of appealing to non-Indigenous Canadians, particularly Protestant middle-class Canadians, and the values that they are attempting to uphold and to reproduce within this country. And by claiming that game, they have this source of identity that is a source of validity, not only within the country, but outside of it, to have Americans recognize that, oh, this native game, this Indian game, they would call it at the time, is from Canada. Now that the Canadians are claiming it, that's a source of an identity. And it, in a way, validates that they're claiming that they have something unique in their identity that is coming from the place of Canada. And so that all occurs, of course, at the same time Indigenous peoples are continuing to play the game. But Beers actually starts forming a set of rules in 1860, and in 1867 he writes the first uniform code of rules. This doesn't mean Indigenous peoples didn't have rules before this. Of course they did. But there was just a different process of coming up with those rules and agreeing upon them. Well, Beers decides that he wants to kind of rewrite rules, have a uniform code of rules that organizations could follow. Well, in 1867, he actually publishes the first set of rules. And interestingly enough, after being introduced to the game of lacrosse in the 1840s and in the 1850s and the 1860s, and these non-Indigenous Montrealers, that is, after they see this game, Beers comes out in 1867 with his first partial ban against Indigenous peoples. So within about 20 to 30 years of being introduced to the game by Indigenous peoples, Beers starts this process of actually partially banning them. And actually what he's doing is segregating them. So in 1867, he comes out with a rule, a set of rules, but one in particular that states that Indians can play in games of lacrosse, but they cannot play for a non-Indigenous team. Either they have to have an all-Indigenous team or nothing, which is segregation. Well, this year also brings about the first kind of national lacrosse organization. Now, you kind of got to take that with a grain of salt because national really meant only Central Canada at this time for lacrosse organizations, Toronto and then Montreal being the kind of two key hubs. Well, throughout this kind of process of appropriation, Beers continues to ramp up this kind of propaganda of that they are now claiming the game, that it's theirs, that it's been quote unquote civilized from Indigenous peoples. And they're attempting to signify this new national identity at home and abroad. They're going on overseas, that is, Indigenous and non-Indigenous teams led by Beers are going on national tours. They're going on international tours, particularly in the United States and then over to England. In 1876, an Indigenous team from Ganawage actually plays a non-Indigenous team from Montreal. Of course, Beers is there and was organizing it in front of Queen Victoria. This is key because what they're attempting to do, what Beers is attempting to do, is to signify this new national identity abroad. But Indigenous peoples during this whole time have never given up their sovereignty, their nationhood, or their self-determination. So what those tours mean to Indigenous peoples, particularly the Ganyagahaga or the Mohawks from Ganawage, is quite different than what Beers is claiming and attempting to kind of demonstrate. So.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, your first chapter, but really in some ways your first three chapters all kind of look at this appropriation of the game in different colonial settler colonial spaces. And I think that was one thing that you really that it was really successful in your work in kind of tracing out that actually in some ways the nature of this appropriation is also kind of related to the power of the settler colonial state in La Crosse, because it had these various epistemologies, was useful for both the settler colonizer, but also for Indigenous Canadians and Indigenous North Americans to resist the imposition of the settler colonial state. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit, especially since you brought up your own family history and you've talked about it in the context of a kind of cultural genocide, but I wonder if you could tell us about how the creator's game was being used in residential schools. What are residential schools? Probably everyone should know about these, but maybe they don't. And how Indigenous people in particular were using lacrosse maybe in ways that weren't anticipated by the settler colonial state.
Yeah, so there's a long history here of this kind of what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded, again, just a few years as cultural genocide. I just generally call it genocide against indigenous peoples. It just cuts right to the heart of what's happened in this colonial history and continues to this very day in different ways. But how does lacrosse fit into this story is really interesting. It's something that I hadn't anticipated when I came across all of this and had started studying this as a MA student and then finally as a PhD student and turning it into a book. But I had mentioned that when W.G. Beers writes the first uniform code of rules for organizations to kind of emulate and to copy and use, he introduces this idea of segregation into lacrosse. So this is only about a couple decades after indigenous peoples introduced non-indigenous peoples to the game, he starts segregating them out of their own game. Well, there's a lot more to come, unfortunately. And in 1880, there is a new organization that kind of forms known as the National Amateur Lacrosse Association of Canada. It's an offshoot of the Canadian Lacrosse Association at the time. And what ends up happening is actually in 1880, Indigenous peoples are banned from their own game. Now, the rule that comes out in 1880 states that no Indigenous team can play for a Canadian national championship or a national championship competition. Now, again, Indigenous peoples, the Indigenous nations and communities that participated in the game of lacrosse, they're never defined by their ability to play for or against a non-Indigenous team or organizations, or even in championship classifications. The best case and example of this is that in 1880, they're actually banned from Canadian championship competition. Well, in that same year, Indigenous peoples and Indigenous communities across kind of Southern Ontario and Southern Quebec actually create their own world championship as what I believe is a response, but I haven't been able to confirm that. Well, there was still more to come in this kind of colonial history, really, unfortunately. And that is just a few years later, what residential school administrators and principals and teachers would end up doing is see this idea that the game of lacrosse was Canadian, that it was considered white enough, Canadian enough, to be an appropriate source of a new Canadian national identity. That becomes so powerful. It becomes so pervasive within the minds of Canadians that they actually start introducing it into residential schools. Okay. A quick history of what residential schools are. So for those that don't know, residential schools were this horrific state-sponsored and church-sponsored, various denominations ran these schools, in which they removed Indigenous children from their communities and attempted to assimilate them. That is, to remove them from their communities, remove and eliminate their languages, their culture, their gender identities, everything that made up who they were as Indigenous peoples. And they would make them live outside of the community and go to these horrific institutions. Some of them had egregious health rates at various times of a 50% death rate because of underfunding, unsanitary conditions. They were a source of unethical labor and of child labor on farms. And these existed, generally we say that they existed from around the 1870s to all the way up until 1996. Now, we know they existed before then. There's actually a really long policy of residential schools in various areas, but as a kind of national framework or state framework, we see them really ramp up in the late 1870s and then really in the 1880s. And what ends up happening is that, again, this idea that lacrosse is such a powerful example of a white Canadian national identity by the 1880s is so powerful and pervasive within the minds of Canadians that what they end up doing is introducing the game of lacrosse into residential schools as a way to assimilate Indigenous youth. why use a sport? The question becomes, why use sport as a way or as a vehicle to help assimilate Indigenous youth? And in particular, why use an Indigenous game, an appropriated Indigenous game? Well, there's a lot of things happening here. The first and foremost is kind of the audacity to come to the conclusion or just to think that you have appropriated the game and changed it enough from its Indigenous history to now claim it as your own. And the Canadians at the time really do believe and understand that this is their game. And it is an example of whiteness. They've eliminated Indigenous peoples from championship classifications. Even in British Columbia in the 1880s, there's a rule that states that no Indigenous people are allowed to play the game, no Indians, quote unquote Indians, and no people of color. See, it was supposed to be, and it was formulated, it was developed and as an example of how to perform whiteness and how to perform a Canadian masculinity, Canadian whiteness, because it was only white athletes that were allowed to participate in this game within these competitions, these championship competitions. So there's that part of it. But why use sport? Well, the idea from residential school administrators is that they need kind of various vehicles. They need a kind of an assortment of vehicles to help assimilate, to annihilate Indigenous identities and languages. And they think that in addition to gender segregation and the introduction of polar gender divide, that what they can do in addition to segregating genders based on Western constructs, that they can introduce sport as a way to teach about and assimilate these Indigenous youth into Western notions of masculinity, of middle-class values, and expose Indigenous youth to non-Indigenous youth. So often what we see is things like lacrosse games and soccer games being played between residential schools and non-Indigenous schools from local towns and local cities, with the idea being that the more exposure that Indigenous youth have to non-Indigenous, to Canadian youth, they will be able to assimilate better into the Canadian system. And so this is why they really ramp up and start using the game of lacrosse. And what we start seeing is from Ontario West, so you have Ontario, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and British Columbia, we see residential schools across those provinces starting introducing the game of lacrosse. And it explodes by the 1890s. It becomes really popular for use in residential schools as a way to be a vehicle for the moral training and assimilation of Indigenous youth. And now what that kind of demonstrates is, to me at least, and what I conclude in the book, is the power of claiming a source of identity, that source being lacrosse. And that's kind of that tension throughout the book, is talking about the ways in which lacrosse is used for Indigenous nationhoods. So I'm talking about multiple Indigenous nations, because the game doesn't always mean the same to every Indigenous nation. The way they articulate their governance and their identities and their self-determination, their sovereignty, it depends on what nation they're coming from. But various Indigenous nations are using the game to do that, while Canadians are doing the same thing, non-Indigenous Canadians, that is. And so we see this power of claiming a source of identity throughout the book.
One thing, I mean, you never leave though in your book, and we've been talking about the settler colonial state so much. I don't want us to only talk about that. But one of the things you never leave is that idea of indigenous sovereignty and indigenous identity formation, that indigenous peoples, indigenous nations in Canada and in the U.S. They never abandon it. They're always, and lacrosse is part of that too. So I would hate for us to talk for the whole hour and not talk about what indigenous nations are doing with lacrosse, both to promote their own specific national identities, whether they're Squamish or Haudenosaunee, but also to help create kind of pan-indigenous identity. So I wonder whether you want to talk about Indian sports days or whether you want to talk, I mean, whatever direction you want to take us, let's talk too about what indigenous peoples are doing.
Yeah, there are so many amazing things that indigenous peoples are doing with the game of lacrosse from during this whole kind of colonial era and period up until the present. And I have a couple that really that stick out as my favorite, a few of my favorites. And that is in the early 1920s, there is a leader of a Haudenosaunee sovereignty movement named Diskaihe, Levi General. He's from Six Nations of the Grand River, so just outside of Toronto. And what he ends up doing is, based on a number of policies that were enfranchising Indigenous peoples, that is, forcibly kind of absorbing them within the Canadian state, Canadian citizenship, what ends up happening is Diskaihe and a number of hereditary council leaders within Haudenosaunee community are looking for ways to continue to assert and articulate their sovereignty as Haudenosaunee peoples, as an independent Indigenous nation. And one of the ways that they end up doing that is using the game of lacrosse. So in the early 1920s, what Diskaihe does is he becomes kind of the leader, the spokesperson for the hereditary council. That is the traditional leadership of Haudenosaunee communities. And as he's becoming the spokesperson, this voice of that traditional hereditary governance system, they come up with this idea that they want to actually approach the international community to fight for the recognition of Haudenosaunee sovereignty. Now, they've never given it up, of course. They've never released or surrendered anything related to their sovereignty to nationhood or self-determination, but they're being absorbed by the Canadian state or attempted to be absorbed, the Canadian state and of the U.S. state, because the Haudenosaunee are actually split by that international border. And so in the early 1920s, what they decide to do, the Haudenosaunee, they decide to actually approach first Ottawa to argue to the Canadian government that the Canadian government needs to abide by the treaties that had been signed and agreed upon in the past and that continue to this very day in the 1920s or in 2020, and that they should recognize that the Haudenosaunee are not simply citizens of the Canadian or U.S. state. They are actually their own independent sovereign entity, of course, and it's always been that way. So you need to recognize that as it had in the past. Of course, there was no interest in doing that. And so Diskaihe decides that, okay, they're going to go to the colonial office in England and argue for this because they don't get a favorable response, not unexpectedly, from Ottawa. And so they go to the colonial office, and once again, they're turned down. Basically, the colonial office says, this is a domestic issue. Canada will take care of this. And it's, of course, a self-serving kind of project for Canada to be involved in this because they're the ones dispossessing Indigenous peoples of their lands, their territories, of their children, of their identities. It's in the nation state is built on that. That's where it actually came from. They're claiming the territories of Indigenous peoples and by removing them. And so what ends up happening is that Diskaihe finally and the Hereditary Council decide they need to go to the League of Nations to fight for the recognition, the international recognition of the sovereignty of the Haudenosaunee. So in around 1922 and 1923, what they start doing is actually trying and attempting to raise funds for their sovereignty movement. And they start hosting Sunday lacrosse games. Well, the interesting story behind this is actually that these lacrosse games are illegal under Canadian law. Now, the reason that they're illegal under Canadian law is because there is a national law that comes to fruition in the early 1900s called the Lord's Day Act. Basically what it does for all people, indigenous or non-indigenous people, it shuts down anything on Sunday. Basically the sales, store sales, libraries, sports, these types of things, because the Protestant denominations are attempting to repopularize the church, basically, and trying to secure membership at a time when they're really seeing a challenge to that. And so one of the ways that they attempt to do this is actually they approach the Canadian government to enact this Lord's Day Act and basically make it illegal to have sales and all of these things and sporting events on Sundays. Well, Skyhay knows this. So as an articulation of Haudenosaunee self-determination, he starts having Sunday lacrosse games. Now, this is really interesting because here you have working class Canadians that is in that have a free day. They have a free day that they're supposed to be attending church, but they have this one guaranteed day now where they're off. And so what they end up doing is by the thousands, they go to a field in Six Nations of the Grand River. Again, it's about 45 minutes, an hour drive from Toronto, just outside of Brantford, Ontario. It's the one of the biggest, I believe it is the biggest community that is Indigenous community and reserve in Canada, at least population-wise. And they go to this community to watch these lacrosse games, and they become these massive, spectacular events with 4,000 or 5,000 people watching these games between local teams, Indigenous teams from the reserve play against each other. And what they're doing is actually raising money for their sovereignty movement. And so what ends up happening is in 1924, Skyhay goes to the League of Nations using the money that they raised through these Sunday lacrosse games to actually fight for the Haudenosaunee sovereignty. Now, Skyhay at the time isn't successful in getting the League of Nations to recognize the Haudenosaunee sovereignty, but I actually conclude in the book and in a separate article called Playing the Creator's Game on God's Day that Skyhay didn't fail, despite the conclusions of many historians that there was kind of a failure of the recognition, because what ends up happening is the Iroquois Nationals, who are the only team in the world, at least in sporting competition, that represent an Indigenous nation as a sovereign nation in official international competition, they would actually build upon Skyhay's arguments about recognizing their treaties, using the game of lacrosse, and arguing it and articulating for the recognition of the Haudenosaunee sovereignty, at least on the international stage. They would take all of those arguments and take everything that Skyhay had done and laying out that framework. And in 1983, they would form a lacrosse team called the Iroquois Nationals to basically have a lacrosse team represent the Haudenosaunee in international competition as a sovereign nation. So that's part of one of those really neat stories that I came across in the book, where in the early 1980s, the Iroquois Nationals start forming up. And what listeners might not know about this team, or if you have never heard of them, the really
I didn't cool know part, about them, yeah.
Yeah, so one of the really neat things about this team is that there are only a couple teams in the world, Indigenous teams in the world, that actually represent themselves as a sovereign nation. But the Iroquois Nationals are the only team that are allowed to compete in international competition, official international competition. So that is, they can compete in the World Cup of Lacrosse. I know there are the Maori All Blacks, but as far as I know, they're not allowed to kind of compete in the World Cup of Rugby. Right. But this lacrosse team can. Well, in the early 1980s, in 1983, there are a few individuals, Haudenosaunee individuals, that come up with the idea they're looking for a new way or a way to articulate Haudenosaunee sovereignty, to educate people about their treaty status, about their independence, about their sovereignty. And one of the ways that they think that they're going to be able to do this is to actually form a lacrosse team to represent all of those things. And so throughout the 1980s, they host a various series of exhibitions, and they travel internationally, which doesn't sound like a big deal to most people. Oh, they traveled internationally. Don't even have to think twice about that. Well, the really cool part about this is that they're actually traveling on a Haudenosaunee passport this entire time. So what they do is in the mid-1980s, they approach the International Lacrosse Federation, the ILF, to compete in the World Cup of Lacrosse. Now, there's a lot of skepticism. There's skepticism from Canada and a lot of skepticism from Australia about this proposal. So Canada says, wait, that you're an Indigenous team, this Iroquois Nationals, and you want to represent yourself as a sovereign nation, even though you're within our territory, within Canadian state. You're going to be stealing from our talent pool if you do that, because they believe, Canada doesn't recognize the borders of the Haudenosaunee or any other Indigenous nation within its nation state framework. And so Canada kind of argues against the Iroquois Nationals in the mid-1980s for joining international competition because they don't want them stealing players from their talent pool. Those Haudenosaunee players, they argue, should be playing for Canada, not an independent team that exists within the borders of the nation state of Canada. Well, Australia has a little bit of a different argument, and they're saying, okay, if we allow this Indigenous team, are we going to have to allow other Indigenous teams into it? And in particular, if this brings about the exposure of these kind of horrific colonial policies that these nation states, Canada or Australia or the United States or New Zealand or whoever else it might be, if this brings exposure and media attention to those horrific colonial policies of our past, and I would argue the present, does that mean that Australia is going to have to answer to their own kind of horrific policies that were geared towards Indigenous peoples? And so they're really hesitant about letting
the Iroquois Nationals. Yeah, they would not like to do that.
Right. Yeah. So they're really hesitant about the Iroquois Nationals forming this team, as is Canada. But there was a lot of respect for the people that were forming it. There's an individual named Wes Patterson, Rick Hill, and Oren Lyons, along with Carol Patterson, and many others that actually helped form this team. And they had a lot of respect in lacrosse communities. In particular, Oren Lyons had played at Syracuse University. So had a very long history of being in lacrosse circles. And so the ILF actually challenges the Iroquois Nationals. They say, fine, we'll put you on this kind of probationary kind of basis, and you need to prove to us that you can financially, competitively, and politically be capable of forming this team. Now, financially, okay, costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to travel internationally with an entire team and all the staff it takes. Competitively, can the Iroquois Nationals, those Haudenosaunee players, can they even live up to international standards of playing against England and playing against the United States or Canada, these populations that have significantly bigger talent pools of lacrosse players? And of course they could, because they're some of the best lacrosse players in the world. And the last challenge that they had to go through was politically. The whole point of the Iroquois Nationals was to represent the Hereditary Council, to represent the traditional governance structure of the Haudenosaunee, and to articulate their sovereignty, i.e. travel on the Haudenosaunee passport. And so the ILF challenges the team and the organization to prove that they can actually travel internationally on the passport. They do so in the mid-1980s. It's not the first time that an individual had traveled on a Haudenosaunee passport. Actually, it was created by Descaihe, of course. When Descaihe decided to travel to the League of Nations with his lawyer, what he ended up doing is not only using lacrosse as a way to fund his sovereignty, the sorry, the Hereditary Council's sovereignty movement, and pay for the lawyer's fees. But he also travels and creates and travels on a Haudenosaunee passport as a further articulation of the Haudenosaunee sovereignty. Well, the Iroquois Nationals take this up and they say, we're going to travel on a Haudenosaunee passport. They successfully do that to England, where they contact England ahead of time, basically say, hey, we're coming. We're traveling on the Haudenosaunee passport. And they successfully do that. And they actually do fairly well against international competition. They host their own tournaments. And after kind of a lot of fights and things that I go through in the book and a couple attempts at getting into the organization, they finally do officially compete in 1990 for the very first time as a sovereign nation in Perth, Australia, which is an incredible story. And it really has nothing to do. Yeah, lacrosse is great and it makes for a great story, but it's so much more than that. It's more about that Indigenous sovereignty and self-determination and that continued articulation of their nationhood to make all of that happen. So there are so many incredible stories that actually I learned throughout this process, working with all those amazing knowledge holders and elders who shared these stories, shared their expertise, shared their brilliance about the game of lacrosse and the stories behind it.
Yeah, I don't. We're getting here towards the end. I don't want to neglect to say that there's so many things we haven't covered, including the ways in which Indigenous participation in the early days of lacrosse was conflated with professionalization, some of the fighting that happened within or amongst Indigenous nations about the participation in the Iroquois Nationals. Disputes between the traditionalists and the modernists. And I wish we had all day to talk about these things, as well as the Australian connection. And maybe we can talk about that a little bit after the interview. But there's some interesting things there as well. And also some fascinating characters. You've mentioned a few, but I'd note also Big John, Andy, Paul, and the Palaces family as being particularly powerful for me as a reader. And can't forget to mention the debate about female participation in lacrosse as well. But this was just a really rich project, methodologically innovative and exciting to read. And I encourage everyone to check it out, and also Alan's other work in this area. The last question is always the same question, Alan. It's a tough one, perhaps for some people, maybe for you too, which is what can we look forward to next? What's your next project?
Yeah, I'm really excited. I'm getting away from lacrosse and sport. I'm really passionate as a historian of Indigenous nationhood sovereignty and self-determination about continuing that and really bringing to light stories that people should know, that Indigenous communities, of course, know themselves, but that it hasn't really made into the mainstream Canadian or international Indigenous historiography. And so I'm turning to a new project in that area, and that is I'm looking at Indigenous iron workers in New York City and across the United States. So ironworking has been a really important source of income and a principal industry for Indigenous communities, particularly for the Haudenosaunee, but other Indigenous communities that really plays an active role in various actual court cases and in various sovereignty movements. Just as lacrosse did, ironworking becomes a vehicle for Indigenous communities to be able to articulate that their sovereignty and their nationhood and their self-determination. And so I'm really excited to be turning to that. I've had some great help already from amazing scholars like Audra Simpson, who's at Columbia University, and from Ganawage. So I'm really looking forward to being able to sit down and write that. That project's been going on for about 3-4 years now, and I'm getting close to hopefully writing some stuff on that.
Well, that sounds great, and I have to admit, there are littered references to iron workers here as well in the Creators game. So I'm intrigued already. Thank you very much for joining us. We've been speaking with Alan Downey, who's an associate professor at McMaster University in departments of history and Indigenous Studies. Did I hear you add that as well? I didn't
say
that before. Yes. He is also the author of The Creator's Game, Lacrosse, Identity, and Indigenous Nationhood, out from University of British Columbia Press in 2018. Strongly encourage you all to pick up a copy. All right. Thank you very much for joining us, Alan.
Thank you very much for having me, Keith.
And thank you all for listening.